Welcome to the Vanderbilt University Center for Teaching podcast, part of the center's efforts to cultivate dialogue about university teaching and learning among faculty, students, and staff. I'm your host, Rhett McDaniel, educational technologist here at the center. In this episode, David A. Padgett, Associate Professor of Geography and Director of the Geographic Information Sciences Laboratory at Tennessee State University, gives a presentation during a workshop co-sponsored by the Center for Teaching and the Tennessee Higher Education Sustainability Association about how he integrates service learning and sustainability into his courses.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm David A. Padgett. I'm the director of the Geographic Information Sciences Lab at Tennessee State University, and so I'll be talking about a couple of projects that incorporate geospatial technology into service learning, and it's a very powerful tool. In fact, this spring, I'll be teaching an online course called Online Studies in Geographic Information Systems. It's open to anyone. You can take it standalone as a non-degree seeking student, and it is designed for anyone from pure novice to mid-range to advanced, and there is a service learning component in the course. And so that's, so I'm going to pass around this sign-up sheet. If you want to get, I'll send you a copy of the syllabus. If you're interested in taking the course. Okay, so I'm going to talk about two projects. The first one is from 2003 to 2010. So this has been a long-range project. Had several partners, Time National Gather, Community Food Advocates, of course. There's Bev. Bev's everywhere. She's two of my service learning courses are students are involved. Most of the students are education majors and urban studies majors. We had a little bit of funding from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation from Centers for Disease Control. So in 2003, that's when I met Ms. Jacobs, and she was part of the Vanderbilt Community Outreach Partnership Center, and I learned of their work in North Nashville attempting to research, investigate, or really eradicate the food desert in North Nashville. And so all of my students have to do what I call community mapping term papers. And so this particular student in 2003, her assignment was to write a paper and develop maps of the food deserts. And this is one of those maps. And so she mapped the supermarkets, the data that we obtained from Nashville's Metro Health Department, and we overlaid that with census data. And you can, just from an eyeball, just eyeballing this map, see that there is somewhat of a disassociation or lack of association between supermarkets and African-American communities in this case. And we made several maps after that in support of the COPC's efforts in food desert research. In spring of 2004, the project rolled over from my cartography class to my urban geography class. And so these projects, the students understand that these projects don't last just a semester, that they're just part of a chain. So it's almost like a relay. So my cartography students relayed it off to my urban geography students. In the spring of 2004, by that time, tying Nashville together was involved in a supermarket or a food store evaluation project. And so they asked us to create maps of some of the problem areas that eventually became Nashville's food desert maps. And this is the Edgehill Food Desert, which is probably one of the most perfectly defined food deserts in terms of space in Nashville. That's a 1 mile straight line radius around the epicenter of the Edgehill community, and you can see there are no supermarkets within a 1 mile straight line distance. So that it's a lot farther walking. Those small dots are people in the community who do not have automobiles. And so that defines a food desert. No car, long distance from a grocery store. So where are you going to feed your children? At a corner store or perhaps at KFC or someplace else? By 2009, an organization called Food Security Partners had come onto the scene, so this was a continuing process. And so working with them and students in my urban geography class, and we also started to work with researchers at Meharry Medical College, we started to look, take a larger look at food deserts in terms of their connectivity with public transit. We started to look at fast food in food deserts. You know, is there a relationship there? Are fast food outlets replacing grocery stores? Is that adding to the obesity problem? Here, also working with food security partners, we start to get a more defined idea of where the food deserts are in Nashville. And we also overlay bus routes and also fast food restaurants. And so these areas have now become areas of focus and research. And so this has come, I want to say, full circle. Here we are 70 years later. Another one of my students is currently providing food desert mapping data to community food advocates. So food security partners became community food advocates, and they have a corner stores project. And so this student's paper this fall is to provide base maps in support of that corner stores project, and that's just one of them in the ArcGIS program. And so that's his community mapping term paper. So that's an assignment. All of my students do assignments like that. So, again, since 2004, we've provided these types of data to numerous community partners. We did an extensive project with Meharry Medical College looking at the connection between food deserts and obesity. We didn't find a strong positive correlation between food deserts and obesity because Tennessee is the second fattest state in the United States. So, you go from a 34 BMI in the food desert to a 32 BMI in Bellevue. So we all need to lose some weight. So we didn't find a strong correlation there. We'll continue to work right now. We are providing, I think the Metro government, or health department, got a $7.5 million for putting prevention for work initiative, and my students are providing spatial data for that project right now in my cartography class. The next project, which is continuing, started in 2004. It's the TSU Campus Community Recycling Project. Many partners, once again, Ms. Jacobs was one of our partners in this. JUMP, United Merchants Partnership, Hadley Neighborhood Organization, Earth Matters Tennessee, Sisley Herring, who had to leave earlier, Gateway Heritage Student Organization, TDEC, Mr. Kesperson, I guess he's George, was a big partner in that, helping us get started. In fact, that's one of the recycling bins that was donated with George Kesperson's help as we first got this project rolling. The project started as a class project in my urban geography class. So the whole class's mission was to get this earth recycling project off the ground. So how did this start? Well, in 2003, there was an article published by relatively well-known environmentalist, Dr. Paul Mahai, who's at the School of the Environment at the University of Michigan. And he looked at differences in concern for the environment between African Americans and whites, and the myth that is the myth that he uses dispelling is that African Americans don't care about the environment. He found, in fact, that African Americans are more likely to buy pesticide-free food, were more likely to drive less, and amazingly, were less likely to eat meat, more likely to be vegetarians. So we African Americans are either on par or more environmentally conscious than whites in every area except for recycling. Notice that there's about a 20% participation gap in recycling. So I wanted to look at the data here locally. So looked at, first, the proximity of Nashville's recycling drop-off centers in black community. And if you look at this map, it's almost as if there's a conspiracy. And I started to think, is the reason perhaps that African-Americans don't recycle, in this case, due to access? I mean, who wants to drive all the way out to Bellevue or Green Hills to recycle? You can barely get people in the South, no offense to you Southerners, to recycle when it's curbside, much less having to drive somewhere. So we first got some funding from the National Wildlife Federation Campus Ecology Fellowship Program, and when we first got started, speaking of the curbside program, we overlaid the maps from the curbside recycling program known as Kirby with neighborhood participation rates, and we looked at neighborhoods in terms of race and ethnicity and so on and so forth. And so we found that in the communities around Nashville that we had in 2006, about a 47%, in the communities around TSU, excuse me, we had a 47% recycling rate in 2005, excuse me, and then by 2006, that participation rate had dropped down to 29%. So we saw that we have a participation gap that reflects what Dr. Mohai found in the study. So the effort of the Campus Community Recycling Pilot Project was to increase the participation of African Americans, first in the neighborhoods around TSU, get them involved in recycling. But before we could go out and proselytize about the good of recycling in North Nashville, we had to start recycling at TSU. So we had to take care of home first, and we really were not recycling at TSU. So we got some money from the U.S. Department of Energy, and in this case, the outreach work was funded through student internships. So my students do outreach in class, but today's students want to get paid. I mean, we would like to be idealistic and think that our students would just do things just because they want to. And at TSU, the reality is a lot of our students come from low-income backgrounds. So a lot of our students are non-traditional. Anytime I write a grant, I don't write it without putting student internships in it. I mean, it has to be done. So a lot of the work here that was done, we had the bins that were donated by TDEC, and we placed them at places around campus. We used GPS to pinpoint the location of those bins, and we monitored those bins over a long period of time to see which locations on campus produced the greatest volumes of recyclers. And that was we had a math major involved in that. We had an engineering major involved in that. One of my best students, Carl Darnell, he was on the payroll during that period too. And he's back at TSU doing great work as a graduate student, graduate assistant. So from 2004, with a lot of community partner help, we finally got institutional buy-in. There was almost no campus recycling projects that were started by institutions. They were all either started by students or faculty, whether you look at UT Knoxville, even the recycling program that went on for 30, still goes on for 30 years at MTSU, which now has a $500,000 endowed scholarship program funded off of recycling, was an entirely faculty and student-run project until the faculty member that started retired. And then, after 30 years, MTSU's facilities management people stepped in. So after just 3 years of students in my classes, researchers, we finally got institutional buy-in. We also had a change in president, but we finally got institutional buy-in in fall of 2007. We formed a committee, and then, once again, Ms. Jacobs was instrumental in getting us to work with the community surrounding TSU. Part of the reason that North Nashville community didn't have any recycling bins was not because Metro government was avoiding it. North Nashville had such a history of environmental injustice and environmental racism that anytime Metro government said we're going to put recycling, all the community heard was trash, garbage. We had the Bordeaux landfill, we've got a demolition landfill over here, we've got a soil dump over here, we had an ash pile, no more dumping. So that message, recycling, sustainability, all they heard was trash, recycling is trash, we don't want a recycling facility. But by having our community partners, such as Ms. Jacobs and my students, and that's Sharon Hurt from JUMP, you convey the message to the community, hey, this is a TSU project working with Metro government. It's not the enemy invading the community with trash. And, in fact, and here's the recycling center that opened on Earth Day in April 2008. So it took 4 years, a lot of students. And that's one thing that we have to tell our students is this stuff isn't going to happen overnight. We have the microwave generation. Email is too slow for these millennials. They have to get a text. They have to get a tweet or a twit or whatever. Say, hey, this might take 4 years. And I used to get frustrated until I was watching one of these 30 for 30 ESPN specials. And John Wooden of UCLA. I didn't know he was at UCLA for 10 years before he won his first NCAA title. I said, wow, you know, that says something. That it took him 10 years. Now, he's known as one of the greatest basketball coaches in history, but it was 10 years before he won that first one. He didn't just get to UCLA and then just start winning. And so we have to get that message across to our students. So it took 4 years, but here we are. We're up and running. Facilities management and police make sure that that recycling center is spotless. Our service organizations are working. And eventually we'll be able to fund green scholarships. And that was a big, big incentive for our community partners. Once they heard, oh, these recyclables are going to be turned into scholarships for TSU students. And you wouldn't believe how many TSU graduates live around our campus. It's unbelievable how many of them live up on College Hill. And once they saw that, and that's great. But in order to sustain this, I'm in talks with the United States Environmental Protection Agency and other organizations to try to get even more funding to make this program even stronger and get out into the community even more. In terms of service learning, so students in my 3,148.50 classes, GEOG 3100 is cartography. Geography 4850 is urban geography. They're required to complete 3 writing assignments during each class. So after they meet the community partners, and I bring the community partners in early in the class period, meet the community partners face-to-face, bring the community partners on campus, expect the students to go off campus and into the community, don't expect that. You've got to bring the community partners to the classroom. And this was reflected in a tragic case last week. There was one of our students was killed. I'm sure you heard about it. And his friends, after he was shot, drove him all the way to Skyline Medical Center for help. And I was wondering, why didn't they go down the street to Meharry? Well, they said the students aren't from Nashville. The shooting was on Jefferson Street. They were blocks away from Meharry, but the only medical center, you know, it's in a panic, you're trying to get to the hospital, but one of the students had been treated for a spider bite 2 weeks earlier at Skyline. It was 9 miles away. Now, who knows whether or not that student would have made it or not had they gone to Meharry. But that just shows you how unaware some of our students are of places right across the street. You can't expect them to walk across the street, well, unless there's a party. But for any other reason, they're not gonna walk off campus. You have to bring the partners to the institution.
David.
Okay. They have to keep a journal of their activities, and they have to do a closed book reflection essay at the end of the course. All of these are graded. And another project that we're working on is at the, students in my courses are required to partner with nonprofit and grassroots organizations and write grant proposals. So the students learn how to write grants, and a lot of our community partners have actually been successfully funded. There used to be the Frisk Foundation Technology Grant. We got one of those for the African American Cultural Alliance, one for Earth Matters. JUMP got one. The Imagine College for Cone High School, one of my students, Tasha Phillips, partnered with them on a My Community, Our Earth grant program for $1,500. And Earth Matters organization got $6,200 in partnership with Brandon Scales. The partnership works because a lot of these organizations have no money at all, and they don't have computers, they don't have the internet, and so our students have access to computers and internet, and so it's a perfect marriage there. And we've had several successfully funded. Final deliverable next week at Pearl Cone High School. One of our projects that we've been working on for several years at Pearl Cone has been to develop a GIS lab. We're going to have the grand opening of the lab that we built with funding from HUD and Ginger Hauser, and also from State Farm Insurance Company next week. And the presentation will include presentations by my cartography students, one of whom is going to be presenting on the Food Deserts Project and a couple of other projects there. And we're going to have some of the ninth graders who've been exposed to GIS and have been learning GIS at Pearl Cone. They're going to do some of their presentations too, so you're invited. I've been told by the assistant principal that you can bring food to the school, And I hope you all come this next Thursday, the 18th, in celebration of GIS Day, 11:30 a.m. to 12:45 p.m. at the 9th Grade Academy. And so, thank you very much, and I guess you might not have time for questions, but...
Thank you.
That was David A. Padgett from Tennessee State University. You can view the show notes, as well as leave comments or questions about this episode, by visiting cft.vanderbilt.edu/blog/podcasts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on this topic, we encourage you to stop by our website and join the discussion. Vanderbilt instructors are also welcome to call the Center for Teaching at 322-7290 to arrange a meeting with a CFT teaching consultant to talk about ways you can incorporate sustainability in your class. Thanks for listening to the Vanderbilt University Center for Teaching podcast. I've been your host, Rhett McDaniel.